It's time for the Access of Easy podcast, the weekly technology digest that keeps you ahead of the curve. Brought to you by EasyDNS.com.
Welcome back, everybody, to Access of Easy. This is number 340. My name is Joey, playing in my Jordan flu game here Friday morning. As always, my co-host, Len. What's going on, buddy? How are you?
I'm good, Joey. I'm just realizing that Diablo 2 was released in 2000. I thought it was earlier than that. So there we go. Good for you for sticking around, at least to the...
I should give you the details. It's actually Diablo 2 Resurrected, which is basically the same thing with updated graphics and some new gameplay mechanics. But that's the best action RPG of all time, I think. I would die on that hill.
Diablo 2 or the Diablo genre?
Diablo 2, I think. Diablo 3 is okay. Diablo 4 is not very good. Diablo 4, actually, for those who are interested in this, which is probably limited to just me on this call, is going through a full itemization revamp because the community hated the way that Diablo 4 items and loot worked so much over the first year of its release that they're going to revamp the whole thing. It's going to take 9 months. So
I'm thankful I got Diablo 3, and I sold it just a little while ago, and I got some Bitcoin with it. Sold a bunch of things to get some Bitcoin. Diablo 4 never even bothered with it. I think I'm done with the Diablo series. Unless they release Diablo 1 again, I would love to play Diablo 1. I know it's basic in comparison to the other ones, but just the nostalgia of that, because I played that a ton back in the day, and that was the first one.
It's crazy,
go back in time and play those 90s games.
The D2 community is like pretty good. I played Project Diablo 2, which is a user community mod over the summer for a few weeks. That's awesome too. I'm always looking to scratch the gaming itch, right? I have like always an itch for a story game and an itch for like a looter. And right now I'm not getting either of them really on the AAA side as far as like PS5 and Xbox titles. So I kind of, revisited these old ones and I remember how good they are. The bar is high.
You're not doing any sports games.
I play a little bit of Madden once in a while, but even that's, that's fallen off, as you know. We've talked about that before.
That's why you got to stick with the classic, NHL 94. 30 years later, over 30 years later, it's still a heck of a game. The best 2v2 game and 1v1 game that there is around, Joy.
The one thing
about those old games, they don't get hacked. There's no attack against those old games. They are what they are. No multi, the multiplayer is limited. Basically, it's the console, two joysticks, and the way you go. So how do you like hack that?
Yeah, you love to see it. You love to see it. Let's, after that long intro there, way far afoot, let's get into last week's quote. Find a place inside where there's joy, and the joy will burn out the pain. That was from Joseph Campbell. A guy named T. Peace, or a girl named T. Peace, got it. So congratulations, sir and madame. This week's quote: if you could kick the person in the pants responsible for most of your trouble, you wouldn't sit for a month. If you know who that quote's by, put it in the comments. No Googling, all that stuff. Do you think that's true? Would you kick yourself in the pants if you had to find out who's responsible for all your trouble? I don't think I would.
I think I'm my own worst enemy. Why not?
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. Come on. There's always things we could have done better.
Yeah. But my own worst enemy. Come on. I don't think so. I don't believe that's the case.
Man, I could have bought Bitcoin so long ago and I didn't. And well, here I am as a result of that. I could have been sitting on a beach instead doing this instead of my basement, but
that's okay. I like the basement studios. Let's hop in. We got, I think, five or six stories here. Lots of data breach and overreaching to discuss this week. Where do you want to start?
Let's talk about AI. It's great, isn't it? Because, well, not really entirely, because you got to consider the potential dangers that come along with something called generative AI. And it's particularly the emergence of a new kind of malware called AI Worm. And generative AI refers to AI systems that can be instructed to perform various tasks for users. And this includes such as writing different kinds of creative content and even scheduling appointments. And it all seems all good and all, but as these things become increasingly interconnected, it allows them to share information and collaborate on tasks. Now, this goes sideways here, because this interconnectivity also creates new security vulnerabilities. And researchers have demonstrated how this is the case. So those researchers, what they've done, they went out and they showcased a special type of AI worm that could infect these generative AI email assistants. And what the worm is capable of doing is not only stealing the data from the emails, but also sending out spam messages. Mm-hmm. And potentially this could cause havoc for email communications out there. And they're able to achieve this by exploiting a weakness that is prevalent not just in ChatGPT, but also in Gemini. That's the Google version of ChatGPT. And those are, I think, the two most popular AI models out there. I could be wrong, but that's the ones that I know off the top of my head. So this ability of these AI worms to infect and also manipulate generative AI systems, this, if you look at it, it poses a serious threat to people's security that use these systems, because the AI generative, it's going to become more and more prevalent, more and more widely adopted moving forward in a variety of industries. Developers are going to be using it, end users are going to be using it, the whole nine yards. But are they going to be considering the security risks that's going to be involved with that? They're implementing security measures to safeguard people. I suspect no. It's just going to be another way for attackers to gain access to our sensitive information, another way to send us spam emails from Nigerian princes. And it's just going to just be an absolute mess unless we're able to shore up these loopholes before it gets really, really bad. So this is done by researchers. Luckily, it's not yet done in the wild. But now that it's been shown off that it could be done like this, it's just a matter of time before people do it on a grander scale. So look out. Be very careful if you are using this stuff. And if you are, try to find a way to close these security holes. It could get rather dicey in a very short period of time.
Honest question for you at this point. I think I know where you're going to come down on this, but I'm curious. I read this story and I think back to the other times we talked about AI. What has AI really delivered that is like of significant value at this point? I mean, there's chatbots, I guess. They're not really that good. The LLMs are kind of fun to mess around with. You can get it to make like pictures and stuff. The responses generally aren't that accurate anymore. We've talked about the feedback loop that leads to that outcome. And now you have this, you know, extra this cherry on top here where you can use this stuff to attack people via email. I mean, attack is maybe the wrong term, but bother people and burden people via email. Are we like maybe a little ahead of ourselves here on the AI thing? Like I look at the NVIDIA stock price, it's like 900 plus US. I think maybe we're jumping the gun a bit. I'm not saying this is going to develop into something that's really worthwhile and contributes to a positive outcome for companies and for consumers. But at this point, it's safe to say we're not there yet, right? There's a lot more negatives here than positives, I think, overall.
I think there is a lot of negatives. There are some positives. It's probably, and it's not helping out. I don't think it's helping us out a great deal. I think people that are using this are people that are learning to code. I think that's the best people that could use this. And I'm not sure if it's actually spitting out good code. So people that are proficient at writing code are not going to be able to use this because they could do something much better, but maybe they could just do repetitive tasks quickly. I don't know. The one thing I see this as being an advantage, it's a more advanced search engine. So when you're using, say, Google or Bing for the select few that use Bing, I find that if you go onto one of these AI things and you do a search, it's much more advanced, much more evolved in terms of searching for something. Hmm. Now you still have to, once you search for it and you get the answer, you still have to confirm the answer is correct.
Yeah.
It's quite often, not quite often, a number of times I've found out that the answer is wrong. So I have to always then search again. So it's kind of doubling my work, but there are times I just can't find information. If you're asking for, say, you know, what was the CPI of Ontario in October of 2001, it's hard to find that. But if you punched it into ChatGPT or Gemini, you probably would get that answer, but it cites the sources. At least Gemini does. And then so you could check that out to confirm if it indeed is correct and also from a legitimate source. So I like the fact that you could use this for a more advanced search engine. But other than that, I mean, I can't see what it can be used for right now to improve people's lives dramatically. But again, I'm looking at this from a very narrow viewpoint in my basement. I could be wrong. There could be multiple ways this could be done to improve people's lives.
Yeah. I want to throw an honorable mention to Copilot, the Bing Microsoft product. I got to say, Len, I think that one's better than GPT-4.
What's the difference between the two?
I had a paid seat for GPT. It wasn't really that good. It was a little less intuitive. That with Copilot, like, you know, if I want to summarize the article from Wired here, Copilot will do it for me in the browser. stuff like that. And it gives pretty good answers generally. I haven't had a lot of trouble with it as far as like data. I've used it to pull like ETF flows and stuff like that. It's not bad. But yeah, I generally agree with all the stuff you're saying there. You kind of, you know, it's an awful lot of value being generated for what it sounds like we both agree is just like a new search UI, right? So I don't know. Let's see. I mean, we'll see where it goes. We always say that every week. We'll see where these stories go. But for now, I think we're a little ahead of ourselves here. Maybe
is Copilot using ChatGPT though? Because doesn't Microsoft own a stake in ChatGPT?
It does use a GPT of some kind, but it seems to me like it gives better results than GPT-4 does.
Mm-hmm. And that
I don't know if it's just because I'm using it differently, maybe, or what. But I don't know. It seems to me to be a little more accurate, a little more, a little less verbose, let's say. Like when you give GPT-4 a question, it just spits out tons of stuff that's just really not needed, right? I just want data or whatever to start an article or something like that. You know, that's what I expect to see. But anyway, we'll talk about that another time. It's interesting all the same to see where this stuff is going. I think we both agree that for now, it's a little far afoot from where the values are.
Yeah, but don't short NVIDIA. That's not what we're saying. And don't go long NVIDIA as well. That's not what we're saying. Do your
Widowmaker. Own research
either way. So let's talk about there's a concerning development, and this is with respect to Canadian cybersecurity, because Canada's Financial Transactions and Report Analysis Centers, FINTRAC, you know, love the long name. I prefer the short name, FINTRAC. They've been forced to shut down some of its critical systems, and this is all due to a cyber attack. And FINTRAC, they're a vital government agency that works to identify and prevent money laundering and the financing of terrorist activities. And their role involves analyzing large amounts of financial data, making them a prime target for a cyber attack. And this is what happened. So with respect to this one, the exact nature of it remains undisclosed as of this time by FINTRAC. But the agency did shut down some of its systems in an attempt to contain the attack and protect its information. And if you look at that, just on the surface, it suggests that the attackers may have been trying to steal sensitive information, and especially financial information, and that would disrupt their ability to monitor financial transactions. And FINTRAC is also working with other federal agencies to restore its systems as quickly as possible. And this shows off, this is another event that, and it's not really isolated. So this shows off that Canada is under a great deal of threat here, because it's a string of recent cyber attacks that has impacted various federal departments in Canada and also agencies. This is a repeated targeting. So it's suggesting that there is a trend here of cyber criminals that want to attack and infiltrate Canadian government institutions, get their data, and use that for whatever they want to use it for. And so this, with respect to this latest one, FINTRAC, though, the full damage, full scope of the damage is totally, at least at this point, unknown. But
We'll never know.
Probably not. They'll give us, they'll give us some surface data, but that's about it, just to keep us in the loop. And FINTRAC, though, they say they're confident it's core intelligence and classified systems were not compromised. So take that for what it's worth. And yeah, I've seen this a few times. There's been a number of different agencies throughout Canada and departments that have been attacked in the past little while. For some reason, Canada seems to be the target of a lot of these cyber criminals. I don't hear about this often about other countries and their departments, but maybe because I live here and I'm noticing more the Canadian side of things. But man, oh man, think of all the information that they hold, FINTRAC particularly, with respect to financial data, large transactions, and who has it, where it gets sent to. That information is valuable. So hopefully that information was not compromised and stolen, because it could impact their ability to do business moving forward.
I assume that it's all been compromised. I can't imagine these guys, you know, would tell us, like I said, if it was or wasn't. But maybe I think the most alarming thing to me here, Len, is how many people in your life even know what FINTRAC is or what they do or that they've been compromised?
Well, the compromised, very few. What FINTRAC does, only the people that work in finance know what they do.
That's it. There's like nobody, yeah. Right? It's like a thing that you're exposed to thanks to Bitcoin, I would say, more or less. And you know, there's a lot of information there that you should be concerned about if you're a Canadian citizen. These guys track, you know, quote unquote, suspicious transactions. I mean, all these like vacuous, nebulous terms, it's so disappointing that we keep on seeing these stories about government agencies here and abroad compromised, hacked, honeypotted, and, you know, otherwise sort of showing cracks in their armor. Again, we've talked about this so many times, but it bears mentioning or you know, sort of requires revisiting. We're in a cat and mouse game now in a way we never have been before. And the nefarious actors are not always state-based. They're, you know, these digital nomad types who want the data. They'll sell the data online for Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies that are more difficult to track than cash in some cases. And, you know, they're not going to stop until they're forced to stop, right? And what you don't see here, Len, is, you know, the talk of who the culprit is. I mean, over the last 24 hours, FinTrack has and continues to manage a cyber incident. The incident does not involve the center's intelligence or classified systems. Like, I don't believe that's true. It's working closely with federal partners, including the CCCS, to protect and restore systems. Fine. But again, like, no indication here of the nature of the breach. And again, like, maybe I'm wrong in saying that they should be disclosing that, but much like the other companies that we talk about that disclose data breaches years down the line, you can almost guarantee that if there's not details, it's because the details are a little more dicey than you'd otherwise prefer. So you know, not much you can do about this. You have to use the banking system here for the moment, if you're a Canadian citizen, and you're going to be subjected to some of this stuff, even if you don't know it, by the way. FinTrack doesn't have to tell you if they're looking at your finances. So you may be involved in this hack and not even know. And I don't think you're going to find out.
You'll get the 1 year worth of...
They'll flip you over the... Yeah. Exactly. Perfect.
One could make an argument that they do serve a purpose, FinTrack, because if you operate within the system, and if you believe the system is there to protect individuals and to ensure people pay their taxes, then that's a whole different topic altogether. But why would one even consider taking out large sums of money and spending it in cash? Granted, it's your money; you could do what you wish with it. But for the most part, if you're dealing with cash, especially for large sum transactions, I would suspect the majority of those transactions are a way of A, trying to hide whatever it is you purchase, and B, mm-hmm. is also to try to stop the paying of taxes. So it's kind of working outside of the system that we all live in. If you use the roads, if you use the healthcare system and everything along those lines, by doing such of those activities, like using strictly cash, especially large sum transactions of cash, you're not paying into the system that you take advantage of. And right. somebody else is going to have to pay for it. So that's the idea behind it. And one may argue it's doing good or doing bad, but that's what they're trying to achieve here. So that's the reality of FinTrack.
Yeah, it's not completely without use and cause. Like, I get that. But it's frustrating as a Canadian to see that they're, you know, I don't want to say they're not taking security seriously. I'm sure they are. It's difficult. But You're in a dogfight now with people who want the data and are more well equipped to navigate whatever security protocols you have in place than you're prepared for. So I expect this kind of stuff to continue.
Now we could move on and talk about something else about what's happening in Canada, because there's a controversial aspect about a new online harms bill, and that is that, well, this is going to grant the powers to authorities that are going to be quite unique. And the bill is going to allow these authorities to place people under house arrest or restrict their movement with electronic monitoring devices if there is fear the person could commit a hate crime in the future. And they're saying this preventative measure is established through a peace bond, which could be sought by the Attorney General or by a judge in Canada. And the Canadian Justice Minister has defended this bill, and he argues that it could create a necessary balance between protecting freedom of expression and preventing online harms. This is Minority Report kind of stuff. Is that
that's the movie.
Yeah. So there are critics of this bill, and they're saying that it is unlawful and undemocratic measures that are being implemented here, and it could grant the authorities excessive powers to silence voices. And they also, the future crime thing is subjective and is potentially open to abuse. Now, from what I understand, what they're trying to achieve here is for people, it's not going to be an individual that has no past, but for an individual that does have a storied past about doing some types of crimes or something that is generally deemed to be wrong by the government, And those are the people that have that type of history. And if they suspect they might be doing something again moving forward, that's when they would slap on this type of house arrest and put the monitoring device on them. So with respect for who's going to be impacted, from what I understand, it's going to be strictly for people that have already a history. So it's not going to be an individual just going to get off the street and they're going to think, oh, you're going to be doing something wrong in the future, Minority Report style, and throw you in jail. It's not going to be the case, but how it's going to, that's what they're claiming it's going to be used. How it's going to be used in reality, I hope it's going to be along those lines, but the reality is this is going to pass. I know this is introduced in the House of Commons, from what I understand, and there is enough support to pass this through the House of Commons. The NDP have expressed their backing of this bill as well. So between the Liberal Party of Canada and the NDP party, that is sufficient numbers to pass this through the House of Commons, regardless of if the other members vote against this. Then this is, so it's going to pass the House, it's going to go to the Senate, and there are numbers, there's the independent Liberals in the Senate, I using that term loosely, but they're a collective group of people, and they have numbers in the Senate as well to try to push this through. So this could go through the Senate and also fly with flying colors as well. So expect this to go into law in a not too distant future. How it's going to be used, again, I talked about it. I hope it's going to be used in the case that which they frame it. It could potentially be used for worse than that, but I don't think that's the case, because if you're going to have a judge put the peace bond, you're going to have that judge convinced that that person needs to have house arrest. But I guess I could be proven wrong.
I think that this is going to become a problem for a lot of Canadians at some point. It's still not really in the... It's not in the modern, you know, the current day discourse just yet, but Christine Van Guyen, who works for the Canadian Constitution Foundation, Canadian Constitution Foundation, she's a lawyer, has an article in the National Post this morning about this bill. And she makes the case, I think accurately, that the problem here is that you're exposing Canadians to tons of legal vulnerability. And with that, you get fees and time spent and all these things. And self-censorship and the chilling effect is going to start running rampant. People will just not say anything online because they don't want to be exposed to this risk. And when you destroy discourse like that, what you get is sort of a stagnant culture. And, you know, I'm not going to go into details here to try and, you know, save myself the trouble. But clearly here, there's the potential for thought crime type you know, convictions and implementation of this law, like you said. I have a really tough time with this. Like, I can't be the only one. And I think that, you know, we've talked about Michael Geist in the past, talk about Christine Van Guyen today. There'll be others, I think, who start to come around and make note of this law. I would expect guys like Michael Campbell, for example, to start talking about this in the near future. And when I think about what this does to Canada, from the side of, you know, through the lens of political discourse, it's not good. When I think about whether it helps or hurts social cohesion, it's not good. You're kind of driving people into their silos even more than they already are. And I just can't think of why we would need this law, Len. Like, are hate crimes prevalent? Is it a rampant problem in Canada? I don't believe that it is, but maybe I'm wrong about that. It seems to me like this is being implemented during a time when people are very much... They're very much in online echo chambers, and it's dangerous to put this stuff in. There's a way to describe this where I won't get myself in trouble, but let's just say this is the time when you could pass something like this, but it won't be used in the way you think it will long-term, I don't believe. Do I have that right? I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on some of that.
It's possible, but there are recourses. You could always appeal and...
But the costs are too much. Like, that's what I mean. Christine makes a good point. Like, being able to appeal and the recourse associated with appeal process isn't enough, because people don't have the money for that stuff.
In a successful appeal, who pays the cost then?
You might pay the cost later, but like, yeah, you're the one who's got to pay up front, and there's no guarantee that you win. You know, you're talking about going against the government in some cases, right? I don't think these cases are against another plaintiff. It's the government that's coming for you for the fine. So, you know, that's a difficult hill to climb, right? And that's why I don't think censorship is two-pronged. It's you know, taking down information, but also it's the chilling effect. And I think you're seeing that here. It's not good for Canadian discourse at all.
Well, you're going to have to convince a judge initially to put the peace bond in place. And that may be easier said than done, but that's the reality. And so you have to have faith in the judicial system, that it's set up in such a way that it's nonpartisan, unbiased, and fair. People may think that's not the case, that there's certainly bias in it, but we got to have some faith in the system, the way it's set up. In reality, if it's trending in the wrong direction, there are options. It's too bad, but one of the options is you got to just pick up and go somewhere else. If you are happy with it, you can stick around and enjoy what we have here to offer. Those are the two options. This applies everywhere in the world. When things get crappy for an individual, they just pick up and go somewhere else. We're not stuck here. We're not, and there may be friends and family and jobs that keep us here. But in reality, if you really don't like it, if things are trending the wrong way, go somewhere else. It's too bad that's the case, that it's being, some people are being pushed to that direction. But let's see what transpires with the bill, number one. Number two, it's got to go to committee as well, both the Senate and parliamentary committees. And there may be some recommendations that come out of it. So this is still the very beginning of the bill. We don't know exactly what's going to come out. If I'm saying it is going to get passed, but if it gets passed, what's going to be the final, this, like how it's going to look in the end once it gets royal assent? We really, at this particular moment, we don't know. There's still a lot that has to be discussed and bantied around to figure out what's the best path forward. So it doesn't look good for a lot of people. A lot of people are upset with it, but it may not be the final rendition of what we see here.
Yeah, I hope you're right. But history tells me that I would bet the other direction, unfortunately.
No, let's see what happens. EZDNS, though, they wrote a blog on March 7th, and this was related to a treasure trove of information gathered through the NAS API leak. And I suggest people just go check out the blog. There's some good reminders on what you should do and what you should not do. And given the information that was stolen, and the reason why it was stolen, it was either due to weak or vulnerable passwords, such as reused passwords, or malware. So those are really the two main reasons why all this information was taken. And it's likely that some of the people here that are listening to this are compromised due to this NAS API leak. So just by looking at the numbers, it's possible that somebody listening to this has been impacted as well. And it's a healthy reminder to ditch the reused or those weak passwords that we use. And also you should look around to see if there's been a number of logins to your vendor's accounts. So if there's a spike in logins to those accounts, there may be something going on behind the scenes that you wish to investigate. And also check to see the last login. Is that from your location or from somewhere outside your location?
That's a great feature, isn't it? Like I got one the other day about my Amazon account that someone broke into my Amazon account, had the password and everything. Yeah. And Amazon luckily will send you an email first if they think it's suspicious. They won't let the person in. So yeah, the location is huge. Like no one in North Carolina in the middle of the night should be looking into my Amazon account. Checking out all the phone cases I've ordered last 3 years.
So yeah, check. You're right. It is a good feature, and make use of it, because if you see something is done like that, where you're getting a login from outside your jurisdiction, something's up. But also, there's let's look at this from three different points of view. Number one, people should be checking for malware. So employ some strategy out there to check for it and remove it. Second is use better passwords. Don't use the easy passwords like 123 password or copy the same password over and over again. Use unique passwords that are very difficult to break into. Use a combination of capitals and lowercase letters and symbols, numbers, all that stuff, and a long password too. With doing so, it's going to make it virtually impossible to brute force it. Also, given that a lot of this information is out there already, it might be a good time to do a mass password reset. So password reset everything you have, start from scratch, implement good password protection. And also, you could also do the two-factor authentication. And EZDNS, they recommend Authy as one, but I'll also recommend and OTP. Pick whatever you think is best, do your research, and with that, it will add you another layer of security. And finally, in this blog, they also suggest, and I've read this before in other places, it's actually a good idea, implement an option to register a separate Canary email domain. and then use the unique email address under the domain for every vendor login. For example, if you wanted to log into your Google account, yours would be Google at your domain. For your Instagram, it would be Instagram at your domain.com. Twitter would be Twitter at your domain.com. So if you use these unique passwords, these unique email addresses specific per account, that particular account could potentially be compromised, but globally it would not. But also it would give you an indication which one was compromised. And then you'll know, A, that the company itself might be a bad actor, but B, you could scrutinize if the password was not very good as well. Mm-hmm. So that's actually a good thing. And you could also do this with, if you use Google email, you could also do the same thing. You could have a number of different emails. So if your name is joesmith at gmail.com, you could do joesmith.google@gmail.com, and that could be your Google address or Google account. For Instagram, it'd be joesmith.instagram@gmail.com, and you could use that for your Instagram account. So you could do that with a multiple different ways, and you could secure your information. It might be a little bit more time consuming to do the whole thing, to set it up and everything, but in the long run, this is a great way to protect your information, but also pinpoint who are bad actors. And furthermore, it can show you if you have a crappy password, and you could just change your habits moving forward.
I am of the opinion that you should also take seriously these warnings you get from your browser or your phone about saved passwords being compromised. I don't know why. Like, there's so many times you're reminded to change your password, and that you're told that you're in a compromising position, and still people, what do? They just click X or remind me later or whatever. Like, okay, man, but it's your data, your credit card, your location, your info, your all that stuff. And in the age of AI, where scraping a database becomes, you know, sort of a rudimentary exercise you can do in a snap, you don't want to be part of that. So I don't know. I would say that marketing team are always ahead of the curve on this stuff. So if you do want to be safe, you know, take care, read the blog. The passwords that people reuse are hilarious. 1234567 89 QWERTY password. It's interesting. I read a story a little while ago, actually, that a lot of corporate outfits and government outfits have this problem where they ask for password resets every 3 months or 4 months. And what people do is they just change the default password that they're given by one letter or one number, which really narrows down the number of possibilities that a hacker would need to try to get into those accounts. I believe that's probably true. I think a lot of people probably just change one number or one letter from their standard, like, day one password, and just rotate through like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 or whatever, and then go back to 0 or back to 1. I it's super dicey to ask people to change their password every 3 months. I'm against that in a big way. But anyway, good story all the same here. Good to stay on top of these things.
Well, Pegasus spyware. Geez, we talk about this enough on the show. And here's another one, because there has been a recent development in the legal battle between WhatsApp and the NSA Group. And that's the one that is an Israeli company that sells spyware. We're talking about Pegasus to governments. So a federal judge in California has ordered the NSA Group to disclose the source code for its Pegasus spyware. And this is insane, as it could potentially reveal how the NSA spyware it actually works and how it's able to target the WhatsApp users' phones. And WhatsApp has accused NSA Group of targeting over 1,400 of its users' phones with the Pegasus spyware.
It's a big number.
And the spyware allegedly allows hackers to gain access to the users' conversations, messages, and other information that is stored on the phones. And NSA Group denies that any of these allegations, and they claim it only sells spyware to governments for lawful purposes. But people complain that there's been misuse by governments to target journalists and activists. And the judge also ordered that the NSA Group disclose the source code of the spyware. So this is going to be a huge turning point in a case. If they are forced to comply and give up the source code, it could shed a light on how the company's spyware works, but it could also show vulnerabilities in a WhatsApp system. And they're saying that they could use these as building new measures to protect users in a WhatsApp environment from future attacks. But another way of looking at this, if you're releasing the source code and anybody can see it, I'm a big fan of open source stuff, but in reality, something like this, if anybody could see it, they could make this potentially even more deadly. And if it's more potent, which is already darn potent as it is, man, I don't know. I'm kind of torn on what's the best direction here, if they should actually release the source code. But I could see if it is indeed released, it would be just game over. Imagine, you know, and we talked about at the very beginning using AI to help you. I could suspect then maybe AI would learn how it is to do this type of stuff just based on the code. And then people could ask it questions and feed it information to try to spit out code that could be far more deadly than what we're experiencing right now. And that would be with very little coding experience. Just anybody out there that could just socially engineer the AI system to spit out code.
Yeah, man.
I don't know, man. This is messed up. But you know what? This is totally outside my control. I have no skin in this game in terms of which direction things are going to go. I have my popcorn ready and I'm going to be eating this as I see this thing develop. But man, oh man, it's going to be really bad if the code isn't that if eventually released.
Isn't it true that smart people are going to start taking basically all their data offline or to personal servers in the next like year, 2 years? Like I'm already thinking about this. We talked about it with Mark a bit. We've talked about it privately a bit, like even for stuff like CBP. Like let's just take all the stuff offline and not worry about any of this stuff. Because the fact of the matter is, as much as I like platforms like StreamYard, YouTube, all this stuff, they're going to get got at some point. Like it's only a matter of time. That's where all the data and important stuff is. Like WhatsApp is kind of small potatoes, I would guess. These other big data centers it's only a matter of time. And for people who say, well, Google's never going to get got, look how shitty Gemini was. Do you think that company is really doing the things it needs to do at the times it needs to do them? Or do you think that they're stagnant in a lot of their practices and are too bloated to get anything of value done in time? I would argue the latter is probably true. And I worry a lot about this. NSO is a group we've talked about a lot too. Like these guys running these spyware operations and distributing the malware. They're not messing around. And how about just one last thing here? The term or the phrase, we only use the malware for legitimate spying. Nice. Thanks. Appreciate that.
Yeah, I feel much more confident. I sleep better at night knowing
that.
Yeah,
same.
Joy, I think that's it.
Okay. Is there one more story?
No, there's a story. There's one more story.
One more story. Yeah.
Intellexa. Jeez, I totally forgot about this one. It's on my list here. So anywho, this past Tuesday, the Treasury Department, they imposed sanctions on a couple of people and also five entities associated with this consortium. Their sin? Developing, operating, and distributing commercial spyware technology. And just hearing about this, why hasn't the Treasury Department gone after Microsoft for their handling of Windows? I would argue that it is a commercial spyware software, but that's just my two cents. The sanctions imposed on these people, well, they froze the U.S. assets and put in place a ban for any Americans doing business with those guys or those businesses as well. And those who choose to break this and do business with them, they could have sanctions imposed on these renegades. So it's very important that people out there know the laws, or else you're going to be having your stuff frozen, all your assets frozen. And Intellexa has been dealing in this realm with the spyware stuff for quite some time. They are the folks behind the Predator, something called Predator. And it's something that enables mobile phones and internet surveillance. And it's been used to keep tabs on people all over the world. It's not just one particular section of the world, man. It's everywhere, Middle East, America, Canada, you name it. But they're stealing data, personal data, all kinds of it, you name it. And the Predator stuff, that's what made the Treasury Department go very hard against Intellexa. And the founder of Intellexa, he's a very interesting person. His name is Tal Dillon. I think I pronounced his name right. Anyways, he previously worked as an Israeli government intelligence officer. This is his pedigree. This is his forte. Then the companies he established, well, he then moved those companies to Cyprus and Greece. Why? Because of lax laws on surveillance technology. So he did his homework and he decided to set up shop in the most friendly jurisdiction for the type of business he operates in. So, but if you look at this, unfortunately for him, he's going to have to go through the ringer, right? The Treasury Department has you under their radar, they're freezing your US assets and they're telling US companies that you can't do business with him or a few of the companies he deals with. It's, it's a, you know, just a matter of time before things get really, really bad for him. But you know what? Given his pedigree and what he's done in the past, I suspect he's going to be doing all right. So it's going to be fun to watch what happens.
He's fine. I'm amazed, like completely shocked. Way had the over a number of times. You were going to mention Bitcoin in this story because this guy may be living on some independent currency, decentralized currency. This is exactly what Bitcoin is useful for. I don't really view the U.S. like security apparatus as particularly potent these days compared to something like Mossad in Israel or you know, some of the other ones overseas. I've heard like France has a good one. I've heard China has a good one, other places too. This guy, I shouldn't say this guy, this administration taking action against people who are, you know, like you mentioned, invested in or developing spyware apps. Like how many American companies, like you said, are taking data? It's not just Microsoft, it's Facebook, it's Google, it's your phone, it's your TV. It's like, it's selectively applied, of course. And I would argue, Len, this is a sign of a, maybe not a huge signpost, but another signpost that the empire is kind of in decline in the States, right? They're, you know, justice for thee, but not for me type legislation here and other ones, you know, of this nature, sort of in the same vein in different silos.
It may be collapsing, but we had a really rousing State of the Union speech yesterday.
Did you watch it? Did you watch the State of the Union?
I watched some of it, yeah.
Yeah.
The first 45 minutes
what
or so.
That guy, like, or, I mean, we're done with the stories here, but let's just maybe closing commentary here on Sodhu from last night. What drugs is that guy on for the 2 hours he's talking? Because he's simply not that lucid any other time, 364 other days of the year. And somehow that night he looks lucid, sharp. He's replying to people in the gallery. I mean, this is not normal. I'm not saying it's bad, but what I'm asking here is basically what is he on and why not just put him on that stuff all the time? Like just help him write the rest of the term and then replace him.
I don't know. I can't even guess what it is or what are the side effects of that. Is this something that you could just use this on a daily basis? What are the long-term impacts? But I guess at 81, what can be the long-term impact?
How long-term are we talking? 5 years, 6 years? Like, who cares? Burn the candle, but man.
He was able, in terms of his mental capacity in comparison to other times, yeah, he was much sharper now. Yeah. He was able to speak clearly, or much clearer than other times, and do it for a significant period of time. And at a late time at that. So he started his speech, what, like 9:15 or 9:20 or something like that?
Later. It's probably close to 9:30 by the time he started.
And for a guy that's 81, and I'm assuming his days start really early, you know, something, he was given something to ensure that he was able to maintain his focus and energy through the duration of this. I don't know what the heck it is, but you know what? After hearing the speech, I'm gung-ho. If I was an American, I'd vote for Biden as well. Four more years. Not just that. We also had the February payroll come out just hot off the press. 275,000 jobs.
All delivering.
Expected 200,000.
Yeah.
it beat expectations.
Yeah, of course. And the Department of Downward Revisions will get that next month. That's it, everybody. Thanks for coming to Access of Easy. Don't forget to subscribe to the newsletter, accessofeasy.com, the podcast, the YouTube channel, all that good stuff. And we'll see you next week.
Yeah, thank you.